12th of May, 2021, 3:02 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is also 2 minutes past noon in Uppsala, Sweden, in a room at the National Veterinary Institute. Patty and I are watching you in your lab through the portals of our laptops. We're hovering in the corner of the screen of your computer, which we know is placed on a small trolley beside your table. It's COVID, so you are in the lab alone, caring for the porpoises that have washed up on that stainless steel platform, stranded. Because of the time difference, for me and Patty, it's the middle of the night. This rented townhouse I'm in is dark and quiet. Upstairs, my family is sleeping. I look outside the window and see two stars in the night sky. I turn back to my computer and you're running your hand smoothly along the skin, moving from the head down the animal. You're feeling for net marks. Bycatch, you say, female, found in the beginning of March. Not emaciated, possibly poor condition, no other abnormalities, you say, fingers pressing into flensed side belly. At first, Patty and I asked you a lot of questions, but now we're mostly silent. I keep myself awake by taking freeform notes, usually 20 or 30 pages per session. It feels urgent to write down everything. Soon my wrist is aching. It's impossible to hold it all. Any photography or recordings of the necropsy room or of the animal are not permitted. So instead of screenshotting you working, I watch Patty watching you. Her hair is glossy black, her red eyeglasses a gash across her forehead. Her facial expressions index what is happening on the table as you attend to this animal thousands of miles away from us. Your voice is still steady, methodically working your way through your protocols. I'm at the mammary gland. It looks pretty inactive. I tried to express milk, but there was nothing there, you say. There's a little bit of hemorrhage, base of the skull, back of the neck, like when the animal was caught in the net and was struggling. Remove the apexial muscle. Now I'm going to open the abdomen carefully, you say. It's a little girl with immature ovaries, which I'm going to remove. I do a lot of necropsy by feel, you say. Removing the tongue, then trachea, just popping out the epiglottis so I can remove the rest, the lung and the heart underneath it. My daughter's calling, you say. Hello? Yeah? Hey. Okay, liver. It's actually really beautiful, you say. Firm texture, color as it should be. The rhythm of the note-taking absorbs me. Focused on your voice, my head stays down for 2 or 3 minutes. I turn back towards the computer screen and I notice how you lay your hand on the only piece of skin still intact on this animal. I think we're ready, you say. So that was an excerpt from a bit of writing that we have come to call necropsy poetry, emerging out of a project that Alexia and I have been collaborating on together with our friend Patty Chang since early 2021. So Alexia is a veterinary pathologist. I am a cultural theorist or something like that. And Patty is a visual and performance artist. And the project is called Learning Endings. Our research began in the middle of the pandemic that's still ongoing. So I don't know what the middle is, but in the middle of that big lockdown pandemic, when we observed live streamed porpoise necropsies conducted by Alexia in her lab in Uppsala, Sweden. Watched by Patty and me in our respective homes in LA, California, and Kelowna, BC in Western Canada. Necropsy, as I'm sure many of you will know, is a postmortem examination of an animal that tries to understand the animal's life in death. Biologists and pathologists measure and weigh, cut open, and narrate these animals from the inside out. These scientists are afforded a very rare opportunity for a kind of intimacy with these animals. Our project was prompted by a curiosity. What might these observations and our observation of these observations teach us about science and scientists under conditions of so many endings? These endings include, of course, the lives of these individual animals on the scientist's lab table, but also endings of lifeways and ways of life in a time of climate catastrophe, a time when so many beings and bodies are stranded and dying, sometimes very far away from those that they call kin and from what they know of as home. What might our observation of the care that these scientists practice toward these dead beings teach us about the possibilities of care for each other? The research included and has included up until now a variety of different stages and outputs. It included interviews with a number of other aquatic animal pathologists and biologists in Europe and Asia and North America, as well as scientific and philosophical research, site-based observations. So far, our outputs have included two short films, two gallery shows, one in upstate New York, one in New York City, a community workshop in collaboration with the Henry Gallery in Seattle, Washington, many performance lectures and academic talks around the world, and a few workshops. Sometimes one of us does one of these things on their own, using our own tools, but all of the research has been collaborative. Speaking of collaborations, before continuing, it's really important that we say that this work has had many collaborators without whom we couldn't have done this work. Of course, Patty Chang in LA, but also Jamie Wang, Susan Reed, Tara Nicholson, sound artist Anne Bourne, Alan Jones, shoreline observers Samantha Lynn Martinez, Jess Saleh Carrington, and many others, including not only scientists, but activists and community members who have generously given their time to talk to us. So behind us here on the screen, we're going to just have some scrolling images of various stages of this research. And during the question and answer period, we're really happy to talk about any of the images or tell you more about different aspects of the research. But for the next 30 minutes or so, we want to do something a little bit different than just talking or narrating at you. I want to interview my sister. Primarily as a way for people in this room who mostly, although I see not entirely, are on the artist side of things. I want us to hear from this particular scientist about what it means to collaborate in an artistic project and how and if it has changed the way that Alexia understands and or practices her work. So that's what we're going to do.
If I could interrupt, I would just like to say thank you to the scientists in the room, because I also thought that this might be a way to at least provide my perspective on what it was like to try and collaborate in an arts project.
Which was for the first time. Like, we have not been collaborating for many years. This was really the first time we did something like this together. We're both in our 50s. We've both had 30-year-long careers. You know, when we were kids, she was the scientist, I was the humanities person, you know, the way kids get pigeonholed in that way. So it's really interesting at this point in our life to come together, to do something together. Okay, so I would like you to begin by introducing yourself fulsomely.
Okay, and I have to go first, so I'm not exactly sure what that means. But Alexia, I am originally born and raised in Canada. I have studied, I've always wanted to be a biologist. It started with a book that we had about Jacques Cousteau, and that set me towards marine biology. And so I pursued a training and spent a lot of time in the field working with marine biology and working particularly with marine mammals, porpoises actually, in Canada. And while I was in the field, these animals are pretty elusive. They spend their whole lives at sea. So I was also working with anatomists, and physiologists, and I really started getting interested in what we could also learn from, well, how else we could study them. And animals, we would find them stranded, we would find them on the bycatch in nets, and we could learn a lot from dead animals. And that really piqued my curiosity. I also felt quite a responsibility working with live animals in the field, and so I went and became a veterinarian. And my intention as a veterinarian was to always go back and work with wildlife. And that's what I do now in Uppsala, Sweden. I work at the National Veterinary Laboratory, the Swedish Veterinary Agency, and we have a wildlife health and disease surveillance program. And a big part of that is bringing in animals that the general public, that hunters, other partners report into us, sick or dead. We bring them in, we perform necropsies to figure out why they were sick, why they died, what other threats they might face, to help provide some kind of information that we can feed back to policymakers. And I'm also, a mother, a sister. I've got Latvian background, speak a few languages. Yeah,
great. Okay.
And how about you?
I'm a cultural theorist. I've been writing about water and oceans for a decade and a half. Mm. I'm very interested in how, this is actually relevant to the next question. So I'm very interested in how, as humans, we relate to the watery underworld that is very distant from us in many ways. We can't live there for very long without scuba apparatuses. And so because we are so dependent on water and ocean health for our own existence, I've always been very curious about how we can make relationships with oceanic worlds. So in 2020, I met Patty Chang, who is an artist in LA. She was doing a show at a gallery, but it was about water and mothers and fear and apocalypse, essentially. And she invited me to speak with her on Zoom at the gallery opening because it was COVID, so everything happened on Zoom. So I was in Australia, Patty was in LA, and we could do this. And after that, we didn't know each other before. We hit it off pretty well, and she invited me to collaborate on a larger project. She didn't know what it was. She'd been invited by a funding body called the Ho Family Foundation out of Hong Kong to put in a proposal for a longer project about environment, I think maybe oceans, but I can't even remember if that was a criterion. But one of the points of this grant was that she was told she has to collaborate with someone who is not an artist. So she invited me. And I said, I don't think I'm enough not an artist for you to get this grant. I think what they want you to do is collaborate with a scientist. So I said, why don't we invite my sister? It was a very open call, like we only had to propose an idea. We didn't need to produce an output. They would fund a number of projects for a 6-month pilot period. And so we said, let's just go for it. So we reached out to you. Hmm. You'd never met Patty, and we invited you to participate. I wonder what your reaction was to that invitation.
First of all, I was super, super honored because, and also very curious. Strida and I are very close, sort of personally, but I understand very little about what she does in her professional life. And so that was very exciting to me. But on a more sort of somber note, this was occurring during the pandemic, 2020. There was a lot of anti-science movements, a lot of sort of anti-science discourse, people questioning a lot of science. And I also was it was a time of introspection, and I was really questioning what I was doing, questioning what kind of impacts, like was my work even worth doing? You know, what was the point? And also being very frustrated in not being able to get beyond my peers with the work that I was doing. And so for all of those reasons, it was extremely exciting to suddenly have an invitation to work across disciplines with some artists.
Yeah. Were you nervous?
I wasn't at first, but that came later. Because I didn't know Patty. And well, we can talk about that as we go through things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said, one of the really unique things and amazing things about the Ho Family Foundation grant, which we won, which was great, because it was a pilot project, there was a huge amount of time to really figure out what we wanted to do together. Like, we didn't have to go in knowing what we were going to do. And because it was the pandemic, that first thing we did together was do like a weekend long across different time zones Zoom retreat where we essentially taught each other about what it is we do. Like, we gave PowerPoints to each other. This is what I do. These are the questions I ask. I'm curious what you thought about that very strange way to start our collaboration.
Oh, I thought it wasn't strange because of that it was an art science collaboration. It was more strange because of the circumstances. It was quite a luxury, something that you never do when you collaborate with other people. I mean, you never...
Rarely.
When do you have time to actually stop before you even get started and get to know the other person's discipline? Whether you might have read their papers. Of course, you're familiar with their work, but really... sometimes when you're working, even within sciences across disciplines, I don't really understand, you know, all of the molecular biology or whatever else is going on here. And yet I'm collaborating with this person and I just let them, you know, take care of that. Because of the strange circumstances, it was really quite an amazing opportunity to start from scratch and just really try and understand each other. And it was although it was the pandemic, we also needed to remove ourselves from our professional and personal lives.
Because we all have kids who knock on the door, you know, at 6 a.m. and stuff like that. So we all went to like hotels in our own little areas so we could, you know, sequester ourselves away and be with each other, but on Zoom.
And because of the 9-hour time difference, we would be in our pajamas at 5 in the morning in LA or like, whatever. So it was extremely intimate and probably pretty vulnerable as well, which is, I think, why we also felt very open. Plus, we already had a very well-established trust relationship. But when you asked me if I was nervous, this is when I started to get a little bit nervous because I wasn't familiar with Patty's work, it's really powerful stuff. It's also, I mean, her earlier work is also really in your face, and I was coming at this, and I wasn't really quite sure if I would be able to do this within my work at this governmental agency.
Like, because of your professional reputation?
Oh, well, both, probably, you know, like... But we can also come back to that. But even, you know, do I do this on the side as sort of a whatever, or do I do this within my actual work at this governmental agency? And again, we can, I think we come back to that. But it was a great start. It really helped. And because it was so intimate, we could really ask each other very honest and open questions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I remember during that time, one of the things we did is, you know, talked about our different methodologies and practices. Mm. And I think for Patty, that was also the first time she heard about necropsy and like what it is and what it entails. And she was very curious. And so one of the things we decided to do with the budget was go to Sweden and watch you do some necropsies, probably record or something like that. But it soon became clear that travel wasn't happening anytime soon. So instead, we devised this idea to watch you doing live streams of your necropsies while we were in our separate and respective homes. So I wonder, like, what that was like for you.
Yeah, again, I think it was just a strange situation because of the pandemic. Because normally the lab is a really busy and bustling place, and it was completely deserted. And I was hyper aware, like we already mentioned a little bit about it's hard to take videos and photos in the space, not because of what's happening there, but mostly the infrastructure because it's
illegal to take photos of the government infrastructure.
Right. So I was very aware that I was completely in control of the view that you were seeing through your Zoom screen, and it was really just the necropsy table with hands coming in and out. And I've done, I've performed necropsies for other people in the past, but I'm also, it takes a long time.
Like 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. And it's, I'm very aware that attention spans are only, so long. And so I speed up in the middle, and I never, they're usually only ever there for part of it. And then,
but it was the middle of the night for us. So we're there for the whole 4 hours, as I already, sort of read out, trying to stay awake. And like when the first time I watched you to stay awake, I just like wrote, like automatic writing almost. Everything you said and some side notes. And then in our first meeting after that necropsy, I said, well, why don't I just read my notes back to you? What was that like?
That was really quite moving, actually, because it's the first time I really felt that, I mean, here I am so focused, as a scientist on whatever it is you're doing, whatever data you're collecting, it was the first time someone was seeing me and seeing what I was doing. And it was just, and hearing that someone was present and that was witnessing this and saying it back to me, but in their own way and in their own snippets, it was really moving and I think emotional and quite beautiful.
And I mean, we might get to this later, but I think out of some of those sorts of things emerged one of the key themes of the project, which was thinking about how art can care for science, or how artists care for scientists. And thinking about that, I mean, we already mentioned that we weren't allowed to take video or photos of the, not of the infrastructure, but you had also told us because of a scandal in the newspaper that had showed a necropsy photo with a lot of blood, you were quite, reasonably so, you were quite reticent to have us filming or doing a lot of photographing. And we talked about that for like a long, long time, about under what circumstances we could take photos and of what. Meanwhile, Patty is a visual artist and was quite like, well, what am I going to make art out of then? And so she asked you, because she couldn't be there, to start engaging in a small ritual or protocol. I wonder if you could talk us through that.
And actually, if we go right back, I think Patty, from my understanding of what she said, she was interested in collaborating after the very first email I sent, because I talked about necropsy and I talked about our protocols and I talked about how I look at the animal in the same way every single time, collect the same kind of information every single time, don't want to miss anything, want to be thorough. And she really responded to that, because I learned that she also uses ritual a lot in her art practice and uses her body and rituals as ways to do her practice. So anyways, she couldn't be there. And she said, I wonder, with all of your protocols, if you could just insert another protocol, a small one. We can't be there. I just want you to find some time before you start and just be with the animal and place your hand on the animal and then take a photo and send it. And so that was something that became the touch ritual.
And the photos became part of what we started to call the touch archive.
Yeah. And I can continue to say that when she first asked me, I thought it was a bit awkward. I thought it was a bit, I was skeptical and I was, I felt uncomfortable. And so, but we had built this trust and I wasn't going to like leave the project. So of course I would give it a try. And I quickly realized I was super self-conscious the first time I did it, because there were people around me and it wasn't comfortable. And so I soon learned that if I was going to do this properly, I needed to actually really be alone with the animal. And that meant that I had to find times either after everyone I got home from work Or we have a big walk-in fridge where we store the animals before we do the necropsy. So I spent a lot of time alone in the fridge and just, well, I wasn't alone. I was with the porpoise. And I started doing this, and Patty never gave me any other instructions. But what soon happened was that I actually really started being drawn to these moments. Like, it was something that I really, really looked forward to, for all kinds of reasons. And I think one of the easiest things to explain is that, like, the necropsy and the things we do, like, time, we never have enough time. Everything is rush, 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 super hectic. You know, things take a long time. You want to do a thorough job, but you have to get through it. It's like, go down and go. And this was a chance for me to take some time and just pause and just ground and connect and just think about the animal, think about, well, all kinds of things about that animal, and think about myself, get myself ready, and then go into the necropsy room and do it. So this extra protocol was something that just became something that I really, really look forward to.
So you say that, you know, when you began doing this, you were a bit awkward.
Yeah.
A bit skeptical,
yeah.
Maybe a bit embarrassed,
yeah,
in front of your colleagues. And another part of our project, though, was to interview your colleagues. We wanted to find out from other pathologists and biologists who do necropsies on marine mammals how they feel doing these. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, how did you feel when we said, now we want to go interview your colleagues for our art project?
Who I would have to be the in, and because they you know, we're colleagues, you know, we have a collegial relationship, we respect each other's work, and it's a big ask, right, to ask them to participate in something like this. And actually something that we didn't get to that I wanted to bring up at this point was when we were learning each other's methods, something that I really got hung up on was the fact that I kept asking right from the beginning, what's the outcome? Like, what are we doing here? What are we going, like, I'm used to setting up something, you know, asking some questions and getting some results. And I already kind of know where things are headed. And I just kept hearing,
I don't know.
We'll see what happens. And so for me, because I had, you know, we had this trust relationship, that was okay. But then to, like, bring it to the next level and to invite people, colleagues, to participate and still not know where it was going to go or what the outcome was going to be, it felt, yeah, it was uncomfortable, for sure.
And I remember we had a lot of discussions about, you're like, well, how could we interview enough to get a representative sample? And we're like, well, there's this qualitative data, you know, and we had a lot of discussions about that, and we did go through, you know, and do like an ethics protocol and a consent form, and we had lots of discussions around, you know, what should be on that consent form. But in the end, you did agree, and you reached out to some colleagues, and most everyone we reached out to agreed. So I suppose, I mean, a question I want to ask is, like, do scientists, I know you can't speak for all scientists, but, like, do scientists want to talk about their feelings?
I mean, of course we have feelings, and of course we talk about them, but it's often in other fora rather than, but I can't speak for everyone. There are scientists who speak very openly about their feelings, but I mean, as a scientist, you're supposed to be provide this objective evidence. You know, you're supposed to be somewhat neutral. I think there's this feeling that maybe if you get too emotional, then perhaps your credibility or the credibility of the results that you have may somehow be impacted. And so I actually started, you know, talking once I got into this project, talking with my colleagues, but like one-on-one and in smaller spaces. And it actually took me a long time to speak in more public events to scientists, because it's one thing to ask scientists about their work. And I mean, it's fantastic. You know, you can talk about all of your results, like a lot of scientists love to share, and this passion to talk about the things that they're studying. But it's not tradition, I don't know, to also in those same fora talk about your feelings, although it is changing.
Yeah, that will be interesting to hear from others in the room too. But a couple more questions before we get to the Q&A. So if we zoom out a little bit, then to think about this collaboration more generally, I mean, what were maybe other tensions or awkwardnesses that you felt and maybe still feel? I don't know.
Well, you touched on the ethics protocol and the release form. That was something that was a tension that came up. We talked about doing these interviews with my colleagues or with other scientists, and Patty's like, and we were, we discussed, you know, what should be on the release form? What are these people agreeing to when we don't even have an outcome yet? And she's like, oh, I just get them to sign it all off on everything.
Like, I can use everything.
And I said, I can't. That doesn't work for me. And so we came to a compromise there, or an understanding at least. Yeah. We kept talking, and this thing about outcomes. I also, you know, it did become a part of my work. I was doing it through my institute, and I also felt sort of a responsibility there as well. It was a bit of a tension. What is going to be shown? What is going to be the outcome? You know, you're handing over this material. You're being very vulnerable. You're doing a lot of things, and because it was, I mean, trust, right, and relationships. I should have never had to worry about that. But you do sometimes have to.
Sure.
In collaborations. Other tensions. We talked about the blood already. That was. And it wasn't just because it was in the media. It was more that, I mean, it was this idea about integrity. And it was this idea about, in the case of the media, they wanted to sell the newspaper. So they wanted this like
gory,
bloody, gory photo. And it was just really tasteless. And and I don't think that was necessary to...
That was a really good discussion, because it got us thinking a lot more about like what visuals or sounds or performances can tell this story. Like, we don't need, like, taking that visual away was actually helpful in a way. I wonder if you could name specific moments in this project that you felt a shift. Or something maybe change in how you approach or perceive your work?
So we've already talked about a couple of them. I mean, the very first one was the necropsy poetry and the touch ritual. That was a huge shift and an opening for me, and just something that I really needed that I didn't realize that I was missing. But also, before we did a gallery show, we did a workshop in Seattle. And there... I think we were interacting with the general public, and they said to me that afterwards that I didn't sound like they thought a scientist sounded like. And I think that's a problem.
Were you offended by that?
No, it was a compliment actually in that situation. Like, it was a big compliment, because I mean, you think about the work, why we do the work we do, and how we want it to somehow be used in a way that could further positive changes, and if that can't even be communicated because I took it as a compliment, because it sounded like in that term we could actually have a conversation.
Yeah.
But maybe I should have taken it as not a compliment.
We talked a lot in the collaboration, about the stuff that you started to introduce. Was that extraneous to your role as a scientist, or part of it? Like, were you like expanding what it meant to be a scientist, or were you adding something on extra? And I think, that's still a question.
Yeah. And the other thing that was a real sort of shift for me was, or an eye-opener, like, it was pretty overwhelming for me to go to that gallery show in the New Burger, where people could come and work with the images that the Touch Ritual Archive. Like, really overwhelming, actually. And we had text sort of that supported the images, and then sound.
Singers and music playing.
Yeah. And the material, the text, if you sat there and read the text, one was the necropsy report that I wrote. The other was necropsy poetry. The third was the text of one of the films that Patty made, We Are All Mothers. It's really, there's some really heavy material in that movie, in all of it. And yet, one of the people there came up to me afterwards and said that it was really heavy material, but they could take it in because they felt supported. And it was, for me, a really big, important reason why I think these kinds of collaborations between science and art are so important if we are trying to engage and have people experience these things. And Patty also was working with some others where she mentioned that they were the general public, and they just said that this was a way, it was a bridge through feeling to feel empathy for some of these questions and issues. And that for me was very powerful.
Okay, so just two more quick questions. Like, for you, why do you think this collaboration worked? Or is working still?
Yeah.
I think it's still working.
I think it's still working. Yeah, so some pretty, we've talked about this a lot, but we really had the luxury of having this pilot project that was funded, right? So we had, that's really rare, at least in my work, that you get paid for six, well, I mean, not paid full time.
We got a budget to work with, yeah.
Yeah, to really take the time to get to know each other, to work out the ideas, to try and have something emerge, and not one using the other's material, but actually collaboratively together coming up with something. We also had, even though the pandemic was brutal, it did give us time, and it gave us this intimacy through Zoom and through all hours of the night and everything else, so that it also allowed for some vulnerability and other things. We talked a lot about trust, relationship building, and it doesn't matter what kind of collaborations you do, but how important that was. And we already had that, and then Patty joined in, and that was fantastic. And we're much more than just...
I mean, I think it's... Maybe if I can interrupt.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say, though, that if it had been just me and you, it would have been a lot harder,
yeah.
Right? Like, it was so good having Patty as the buffer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Three works really well.
True. And also we're connected in so many other ways than just...
Like the three of us too, yeah.
Yeah, we were all mothers around the same age. All kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that also helped make things work. Mm-hmm. And we were curious, and then we were willing to put in the work because of our trust to work through these tensions when things were kind of a bit meh.
So maybe to, before we go to the Q&A, like, could you summarize, or suggest, like, how engaging in this project has changed you, like, professionally or personally?
Yeah, it's really hard to just say it. First of all, I mean, if we go back to right where we started, about I was sort of questioning the work that I do during the pandemic when you first gave me that information. It really, like, helped me sort of reaffirm what I do and why, and it, because you helped me look at what I do in different ways, gave it a broader perspective, helped me also re-examine pretty carefully and critically what I do. So that was fantastic. I'd been working as a pathologist for so long, even though I was trained as a veterinarian, I didn't really feel like I was tending or caring like a veterinarian, but it also helped me remember that actually, yes, I am in my own way by learning, by hopefully, you know, with the information going back to living populations and individuals and policy and all kinds of other things. I learned a ton about just my about worlds that I don't normally work in, and I got to be a lot closer to you and actually understand,
figure out what it is I do for
exactly,
a living.
Exactly. And I really just really, really strongly believe in, you know, I have scientist colleagues, friends who are really sort of really high positioned, and they have the opportunity to really talk to the ear of policymakers and government and can make an impact that way. But most scientists can't. And this is another way, I think, for us to not have an impact, but at least help others or have our work sort of be experienced in different ways in different publics. I really believe in it.
Well, thank you for letting me interview you. I think we would both like to, though, also open up for questions, either to either of us specifically about certain parts of the project. We tried to sort of fill in some of the blanks about, you know, how it happened and what we did, but it's been going for 4 years, so there are probably some questions. So over to you. And I will just repeat and or paraphrase your question for the microphone. So that's why I'm doing that. So you're looking at, so the question was about what the images on the screen are showing. So there are, obviously there are some pictures from Alexia doing necropsies and of the touch ritual. Those are what many of those photos are. This one, this show here with the hall and these pictures that are being flipped over. So this was something that Patty and I tried out in a workshop when we were first workshopping what to do with audiences. And it had come out of Patty being in her garage studio with a bunch of the photos on her work table. And her son, who was about 8 years old at the time, came in and was looking at all of these photos of parts, you know, the marine mammals deceased. And he just one by one started to flip them over, like he didn't want to see them. And we started to talk about that in one of our Zoom meetings and how much it reminded us of like a memory game that children play. And so Patty started to develop this interactive piece for a gallery where there would be all of the photos turned down and people could interact by flipping them up one by one and looking at them, maybe matching them, maybe not, that wasn't really the point, but sort of being able to look at this quite overwhelming thing at a pace and in the amount that you can handle, you know? When we wanted to put the Touch Archive on our website, which is not very updated, apologies, but there is a button at the top of the learningendings.org website where you can look at the Touch Archive. And when Patty first did it, like all of the photos were just there. And we're like, it's just too overwhelming. So similarly, you have to touch them with the cursor to turn each one over. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the a show in the Neuberger Gallery in Purchase, New York. There were also, there was a soundscape in the room. And then as Alexi said, there was the screens with the different texts on it. And it was quite an open space that people could come into, hear the music. Our friend and colleague Anne Bourne had made a score for voices. So there were volunteers singing in different parts of the room. And every
time you flipped an image, the singers would activate.
Yeah, oh, I forgot about that part. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, right. I forgot about that. So you'd flip it and then the singers would start to vocalize. The walk, so the outdoor photos are from a walkshop we did in Seattle, in West Seattle, in a park called Lincoln Park. Patty had been invited by the Henry Art Gallery to do something? And she's like, I'm working on this project. Maybe we could show something from this project. And then I said, well, I do these community walks. Maybe we could do one of those. The gallery was quite interested in that. There are, whale strandings all up and down the Pacific Northwest shore. And there had been a whale that had stranded in 2016. I'm terrible with numbers. 2016, 2017, right at a ferry terminal that's right near this park. So we scored about a 3-hour long walk where we brought a bunch of community participants through the forested top area of the park. We did several things. They listened to Alexia have a conversation with a biologist named Jesse Huggins, who was on site during that stranding of that whale at the Fauntleroy terminal. And Jesse sort of told the story of that. The whale was still alive when it stranded, so there was a lot of community care to sort of keep the whale wet, to try to save it. And then, you know, a shift to palliative care when they knew the whale wouldn't make it. So we got this story. We invited everyone on the walk to carry 3 buckets of water and sort of share the weight of carrying that. And then down the escarpment to the beach where we gathered and used the buckets of water to slowly wash each other's hands one by one and then rematriate the water to the sea. And then, you know, we had conversations around that. There were other parts to it. I'm not giving the full details. And then, so those are mostly those photos here. So a couple of the different performance pieces that we've done out of it that were, you know, both of them a mix of sharing some information about this practice of necropsy, but also trying to put it in context of bigger questions of palliative care, care for the dead, and, you know, how art cares for science, if it can. The question was about what changed in my astritis practice. Similarly, this opportunity to have this long-standing collaboration with my sister and Patty has been amazing, but to be brutally honest, there were many times in the project where I didn't know what my role was. You know, the artist had a very clear role, and the scientist had a very clear role, and I sometimes joked that my very clear role was writing really good emails.
So not true.
No, but it's totally true, because whenever we had to reach out to one of the scientists or to someone, they're like, oh, Srita, you write the email. And I kind of joke because when I saw that happening, I think I was actually a bit annoyed. Like, I'm like, I have skills, I have talents, you know, all I'm doing is writing emails. And then slowly, as the project progressed, I started to really value the skill of writing good emails as a sort of stand-in for a bunch of labor that is, a version of domestic labor, a version of keeping things connected, of being the connector person, of writing the abstract, of making the summary. And of course, in my own practice, there are parts that fit very clearly. Like, I've done some performance lectures and sort of offered it as a lyrical text to others, combining it with other work I've done around holding and feeling and touch and sort of human and non-human, sort of a sharing of a sensorium that humans and non-humans have. So I've like integrated it into other questions I've been thinking about. And so brought it in that way to my own work. I think it's also worth saying that while this project was going on, our dad was dying, and Patty's dad had just recently passed away. And it was a really amazing way to think about death in a very close-up, but slightly also distanced way. I'm not sure if the themes that emerged would have emerged so strongly if we weren't thinking and being with death on a really daily basis for 3 of those years.
For the record, Astrita pretty much orchestrated and put together the whole workshop. and you have always described yourself as the writer. and have written some really beautiful things and put to words the things that you know that I haven't been able to express through words and you know, likewise Patty. So she played a very big role.
But also to say it's good to have an email writer, right? Like it's a really and I'm it's funny for me to say that, but it's also true, right? Like you need also the I don't know, like you're all too young to remember the show Love Boat, but like the social convener, like the one who sort of pulls things together and connects people, you know? It's one of the great joys of my life that I've been able to introduce Patty and Alexia to each other, you know? So just for the mic, the question around for Alexia, how the touch ritual changed your feeling going into a necropsy, and for me, how my feelings might have changed, you know, participating in the scientific process as an observer.
Yeah, so the connection, when I put my hand on the animal and the feelings, it was there in that moment. And it was very much, I had worked with live porpoises in the field. I've seen them lots of times at sea. And it was a way for me to, I could visualize a version of that animal. I could connect, I could ground. But then I don't know how much it changed when I went into the lab. Because when I went into the lab, you know, there are things like I still was as thorough. I was still as committed. I was still as what I did. But I left that, you know, when I walked into the lab to do the necropsy.
And many of the scientists we interviewed said something similar about, like, you know, when we were talking to Jesse about the Fauntleroy stranding, she's like, there's a shift from the care for the dying to then shifting into scientific perspective to do the scientific work. And Francis said that something like that as well. Yeah.
And it's still such a privilege and an honor and a marvel and everything else and still very intimate, like being there. But that was there before as well. But I had this moment of just time and a pause and a connection.
And I think for me, you know, one of the tensions actually for me going into this was, you know, I think Marjolein, you said, what did you say today? You're a critical friend of science.
I thought you were going to say that, bring this up actually.
Yeah, like someone who's done a lot of reading and, you know, critical theorizing around Western science. I was a little bit nervous because I knew my sister would not take well. And what was the point of me even going in with a sort of critical or a closed view that what she is doing might somehow for me be like objectifying the animal? And I remember I asked you about that once. I said, don't you, like, isn't this kind of an objectification of the specimen? And I remember your response. You were like quite taken aback. And you were like, I don't do this for me. I do this for the animal and for all the ones that come after it. And I think if my feeling has changed through this project, it's to be more present to the life worlds of science rather than just thinking about it as an abstract regime that is quite easy to criticize. In all sorts of ways. I mean, I think both of us and probably all of us would agree that there are many ways science could be done better. We've talked about that already in our time yesterday up looking at the sites. We can ask lots of good questions, and opening this up was a space where, you know, Alexia spoke a lot about trust and the relationship building. Like, I think I can now ask hard questions about science and scientific practice to you, and you won't have maybe such a quick reaction about, like, I'm being critical, you know. I'm curious, and I think we're both more curious coming out of this. Sure, so just to repeat the question or just summarize it, Taylor was asking about vulnerability and overwhelm and a lot of these words that Alexia used, and mentioned that, you know, in your own collaborations with scientists, Taylor, that you often feel like the vulnerable one, but here it maybe sounds like you might have been bearing more of the vulnerability given your position. Maybe some thoughts on that.
And it's funny, I've never thought about it that way, that it was until you reflected it back at me that made, but because I definitely, I didn't feel vulnerable with my collaborators, with these two. I more felt vulnerable about not knowing what the outcomes were going to be, how the material was going to be used, that kind of a thing. And I think we all kind of, by being in our pajamas in the middle of the night with this, I think we all felt a little bit sort of vulnerable. And it was a good thing. Like it was a way to actually help us open up. And the overwhelmed, that was because, well, I don't know what it was, but it was a woman at the show asked afterwards, you know, she said, Alexia, so here you are, you've been doing this intimate ritual. You've got all of these images, all of these people are interacting with them. They're up on the screen, you know, they're whatever. How does that make you feel? And I was just like, oh, really, really overwhelmed. And that's when, like, sort of the caterpillar moment where I felt this hand on my shoulder, because it was Astrida beside me, and then Patty's hand on Astrida's shoulder, and then Anne's hand on Patty's shoulder. And it was just, I mean, like, it was, yeah. So I have always felt supported with the team here. So
yeah, I mean, I just wanted to briefly sort of say, I don't know if it's exactly what you feel, Taylor, but like I certainly felt vulnerable asking, like extending the invitation to you. And I mean, that's less about you personally, but about bigger contexts where science gets a lot of money, science gets a lot of prestige, even now in a time of, you know, anti-science and sort of all this bullshit about, you know, we won't have to go there, but you know, science is vulnerable right now. But despite that, you know, the big grants, the big money all goes to science. And so as someone who writes things, not just emails, you know, you do feel a bit of vulnerability, like saying like what I do is important too, you know, and might even have something to add that's not just science communication. You know, and I remember sort of moving toward that moment in one of our very first Zooms when we were like, this isn't going to be science communication. We don't know what it is, but it's not going to be that. And it's not going to be just artists or theorists taking scientific data and doing stuff with it. It's going to be something different, even though we didn't yet know what that different was. And it felt quite vulnerable to say, like, actually, we have something that we think scientists could benefit from, you know, not just personally, but as, you know, a profession. We have ways of asking questions and looking at things sideways and from different angles and connecting them up to other bigger questions. And so that does feel a bit, you know, like who wants to listen to little old me, you know? But that we got over that, and then that, but it's still a bigger question, I think, in you know, the funding world, in the university world, in the, you know, foundation world.
But I just wanted to, I was just curious. I mean, yeah,
if there was she wants any... to know if any of the scientists have questions
or any comments, or if not, that's fine. But I'm like, we're here this week and next week. It'd be great. I'd just be interested to talk with you as well, because this is just one scientist's perspective.
Yeah. So the question is just about, you know, is like, what's wrong with science communication in
there,
a way?
There isn't.
No,
there's nothing.
Yeah. Did you find it like boring? Because you were like, we don't want to do science.
Well, I mean, I think the what I meant there was we don't want it to be like the kind of science communication where the artist's role is simply putting the scientific data into a medium that can be consumed by the public. We wanted the artist's role to also be to intervene and ask questions about the scientific practice and maybe even change the scientific practice in some small way. And I mean, I don't think it happened in any big way, but the fact that Alexia is now you know, all the things, I'm not going to repeat, you know, all the things she said. And now she just went to, you know, a conference in Australia last December and talked about this project and how it's impacted her work. To scientists, I think, is more than science communication, because it's going back to the practitioners of the science, not just out to the public.
Yeah, I do. I don't take a picture. Oh, sorry. The question was, do I continue with the touch ritual? Even now? Yeah, I do, but I don't take photos.
We have overstayed our welcome. So thank you so much for your questions and your listening and your ears. Thank you.
Thanks.